The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I'm very pleased that you are all here. And I'm also pleased to introduce our guest this evening. I think it's nearly impossible to grow up in this area without some seemingly specific knowledge of the Calder family. Whether it's Alexander Milne's statue of William Penn, Alexander Sterling's Swan Memorial Fountain, or Alexander Jr. Jr.'s mobile ghost at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, the Calder family's contribution in Philadelphia is nonpareil. That contribution is given fresh voice by Jed Pearl in his new biography of the youngest of the three sculptors. Calder, The Conquest of Time, The Early Years, 1898 to 1940, is a richly illustrated volume based on letters and papers previously unavailable to researchers. Pearl was a longtime art critic for The New Republic, a contributing editor at Vogue, and he has authored a number of books, including Magicians and Charlatans and New Art City, Manhattan and Mid-Century, which a writer in The Washington Post called the sort of grand marriage of criticism, history, and biography that Edmund Wilson achieved in his finest books. His new book has received similar praise in The Times, Post, and Journal, among other publications. Please welcome Jed Pearl.
Hi, thank you. I'm delighted to be here in Philadelphia, Calder's city, the city where he started out, where his parents met. And I'm being delighted to be here to talk about what is the first biography of Calder. Calder died in 1976, but it's been over a generation before the family, the Calder family, felt comfortable with the idea of a biography, and I've been the guy who's been lucky enough to begin to put this story together. What I wanted to do this evening was focus on three moments in the story that I tell in this first volume. This volume takes Calder up to the year 1940. He was born in 1898, so he's in early middle age, if we can call our early 40s early middle age, when this book ends. And what I'm going to do is first focus on his childhood for a minute and some of the interesting issues around his childhood, his relationship, is the importance of his parents, and then jump a little bit forward to look at the whole question of his turn to abstract art in the early 30s, and then look more generally at the whole question of how this man brought modern art into what many people regarded in the 1930s when he began to do kinetic sculpture. Many people regarded the mobile as taking art into the fourth dimension of time. So I'm going to kind of circle a bit around these three moments in his life and in his work. And partly what I want to show you is how I approach the task of writing a biography. A biography is, of course, a story, and I think there are parts of this biography that have almost the excitement of a novel when Calder meets the woman, Louisa James, who he will marry, and they had this extraordinary marriage for 45 years. He meets her on a boat, the De Grasse, going back from France to America in 1929. There's this incredible sort of blooming, blossoming love story. So there are moments like that in the book, but there are other moments where I really try to dig down into the whole question of how does somebody develop the kind of imagination that Calder has? Where does it come from? What is the nature of, dare I say, using a kind of big word that I think we get very nervous about nowadays, what is the nature of genius? And Calder, to understand Calder's genius, I think you really have to look at his upbringing. And here you have on the right, a photograph of Calder taken in the 1950s in his house in Roxbury, Connecticut. He and his wife spent, it was kind of their main base of operations in Litchfield County in western Connecticut, although they, in their later decades, they spent more and more time in France. And here's Calder in the big living room in the house in Roxbury, taking a nap, as was his wont. He was a man with preternatural energy, and he would kind of go and go and go, and then he would nap, and then he would open his eyes and go again. And the reason I'm showing you this right now is, on the wall of the living room in Roxbury is this painting. And what is this? This is a painting of Calder around the age of six or so by his mother, Nanette Lederer Calder. Calder's mother was born in a Jewish family in Milwaukee, and she had the art bug. And in her 20s, when her father died and she inherited some money, she went off to Philadelphia. She came here to study at the Pennsylvania Academy, and then she went to Paris with some friends. And it was in Philadelphia that she met Calder's father, Sterling Calder, who is, I'm sure everybody in this room knows, is this sort of the middle of the three Calder sculptors. Sterling, you see on the left, Sterling, who was a very good-looking guy, kind of dandyish fellow, with Nanette in Paris around 1895, shortly after they've gotten married. I mean, Calder's parents were bohemians. They were bedrock bohemians. And on the right, you see a wonderful photograph from a series by a friend of Nanette, by a friend of Calder's mother, a woman named Eva Watson Schutz, who was a very well-known pictorialist photographer. And with anybody here know about the Plastic Club in Philadelphia? Calder's mother was one of the founders of the Plastic Club. Her name is on the founding meeting of the Plastic Club. And one of the other early members was her friend, Eva Watson, who became Eva Watson Schutz when she married a professor at the University of Chicago. Anyway, Eva Watson took these photographs of Calder's mother and Calder and his sister. This is a photograph of Nanette with the young Alexander Calder. So Calder grows up in this family where art is the air that everybody breathes. Here's a sculpture of Calder by his father, Sterling Calder, called The Man Cub, done when Calder was about 3 years old on the left. On the right, you see a fountain, the Fountain of Energy, that Calder's father designed for the Panama Pacific Exposition in San Francisco in 1915. And the Calder family spent a number of years in San Francisco when Calder was a teenager. And in the teens and 20s, Calder's father, Sterling Calder, was one of the best-known sculptors in America. So this is the world in which Calder grew up. And sometimes people have told the story as if Calder's parents were sort of old-fashioned, fuddy-duddy artists. And, you know, maybe you look at their work today, and they were realists. But they regarded themselves as modernists. They were friends with people like John Sloan and Robert Henry and William Glackens, who all started out in Philadelphia together, really, studied with Aikens. Calder's father studied a little bit with Aikens. And then this whole kind of cohort gravitated to New York, and a lot of Calder's parents' friends came to define what is known as the Ashcan School, painting the kind of scruffy street life of New York City. So this is the world in which young Calder grew up. And this world has much more to do with who Calder became, ultimately, than I think anybody has ever realized. Calder's father got tuberculosis when Calder was about 7 or 8 years old. And they ended up living in the Southwest and then in Pasadena for a few years because the climate was supposed to be conducive to a cure. In fact, Calder's father was cured. And here on the left, you have the family in Pasadena. They were there for a couple of years, 1907, 1909, somewhere in there. And in Pasadena, Calder, 10 or 11 years old at the time, did these two Where's my point? These two tiny sheet brass sculptures, they're about a couple of inches high. He made them for his parents for Christmas presents. And he thought they were so important, okay, that in 1943, when he was 45 years old, one of them was shown as the first object in his retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art. Okay. And so we've always known about these. And then I started like kind of looking into Pasadena. Pasadena around 1910. Well, Pasadena was one of the hotbeds of the arts and crafts movement in America. And it turns out that Calder's parents were friends with all of these people. They knew Green and Green, the well-known architects who were kind of the brothers who were kind of the Southern California equivalent of Frank Lloyd Wright, bringing Asian ideas into American architecture. They knew a lot of the metal workers. They probably knew a guy by the name of Douglas Donaldson, who did these sheet metal birds on a lamp and cut out this sheet metal street sign for a house. And it began to become clear to me that Calder, this very bright, creative boy in a family where creativity was revered, was in contact with, in some way, whether somebody like this guy Donaldson was actually helping the young Calder, showing him how to bend metal and cut sheet metal, or whether he was just seeing these things, he was getting ideas from the people around him. And then when I began to think about this, what's the arts and crafts movement all about? The arts and crafts movement was started in England with John Ruskin and William Morris, was a kind of revolt against the standardization and industrialization of humankind in the 19th century. It was a movement back to direct use of and manipulation of materials. And then you start to think about Calder and his entire career. This man who, as a boy, had a shop, a workshop that his parents gave him, and that as a grown-up artist, never called the place he worked a studio. He also always called it his shop. You begin to think about this, and what I began to realize was that in some way, Calder, through his parents' embrace of the arts and crafts movement and their friendships with that movement, Calder becomes, in a sense, through his whole career, a kind of exemplar carrying the ideas of the arts and crafts movement into all kinds of places. On the right, you have here various brooches and pieces of jewelry that Calder made in the 1930s and 40s. This is a watch fob, an arts and crafts watch fob, made around the turn of the century in Massachusetts. Now, I'm not saying that Calder was influenced specifically by this, but objects like this and the arts and crafts interest in the spiral and other images derived from Native American culture, these things greatly interest the arts and crafts artists and arts and crafts workers. And these things all recur in Calder's later work. In Pasadena, there's a house, a kind of elaborate castle-like house called El Alisal, owned by a man who I'm sure Calder's parents knew and visited. And on the door of this house, there's a wrought iron decoration by a man named Maynard Dixon. And when I came upon this, and I actually, I've become very close to some members of the Calder family, including the grandson, the youngest of the four Calder grandchildren, who runs the Calder Foundation. And I sent him this in the middle of the night. And I said, you know, I think your grandfather probably saw this when he was a boy. I can't be sure. And he was like, oh, my God. Now, here is a napkin clip that Calder did in the 1940s. Now, again, I'm not saying he was thinking specifically of this, but this kind of imagery, the interlacing, the meandering line, which was so important to Calder's art, this is something he was encountering as a boy in this wonderful artistic family in Pasadena. And again, when you start to think about a lot of the kind of secondary things that Calder did, this is the kitchen in Roxbury, Connecticut, where Calder made almost all of the utensils. You know, his wife would be like, they'd be having a lot of people for dinner, and she was serving soup, and she was like getting tired of using a small spoon to take ladle out the soup. And she'd say to him at lunch, oh, Sandy, you know, could you make like a big spoon? So then there's this huge, gorgeous brass spoon that was, you know, just used to take soup out. And of course, Calder's jewelry, much of it made for friends, for family members, every single piece unique. There were certain points in his life where people wanted him to, to allow replicas of his jewelry to be made. He would never permit it. Every piece had to be unique. Again, very much an idea that takes you back to the spirit of Ruskin and William Morris. So there's definitely echoes of the arts and crafts movement and his parents' relationship to that in the things like the jewelry and the utensils, the household elements that he made. But when you begin to think about his sculpture, and this is a marvelous sculpture of Josephine Baker done in 1928 when Calder has been living in Paris for a couple of years, Josephine Baker, the great African-American dancer who was such a sensation in Paris. When you begin to think about Calder's sculpture and the elegance with which pieces of wire are attached, the beauty with which a wire will curl around another wire. And the next time you're in a museum, go really as close to a Calder as they'll let you go and look at how things are attached, the elegance of the attachments. All of this, again, derives from this focus on the made thing and the sense of the making of it as something that's there in the mature work. These are great mobile called Eucalyptus from 1940. This is a show of Calder's work at the Pierre Matisse Gallery in New York in 1940. I really think that this sense of the artisanal, of the made thing, the centrality of the making of it is key to the power of Calder's work. And again, I think it's something that goes back to his parents. His mother, in a letter, the Calders were great letters writers. There are hundreds and hundreds of letters. His mother, in a letter to her daughter, to Calder's sister, who was 2 years older than him, and actually had been born in Paris. They called her name was Margaret, they called her Peggy from Paris in the family. But her mother, Nanette Calder's mother, said in a letter to Calder's sister, I've always been amazed at how you and your brother use your hands and the skill with which you manipulate materials with your hands. And that sense of the made thing, the power of the making, something that comes from his family and is there, I think, throughout his career. The second kind of moment in Calder's life and career that I want to focus on for a minute is his shift, a very dramatic shift between like 1929 and 1931 from the kind of work you see on the left. This is the wonderful Brass Family from 1929, which is in the Whitney Museum in New York. The shift from that to these very, very austere abstractions, such as Crozier from 1931, which you see on the right. How does this happen? How does an artist so dramatically shift from one kind of work to the other? And indeed, when the abstract works were first shown in Paris at the Galerie Percier in 1931, the dealer insisted on hanging at the same time up above some of these wire portraits that Calder had been doing for a few years before. So you had, at this first show of the abstract work in 31, you actually had this juxtaposition of what he'd been doing in the 20s and really up until 1930, and then this shift to these radically reduced, purist, austere abstractions of the early 1930s. Now, how does this happen? How does an artist's work change so dramatically? I mean, this is one of the questions I asked myself in working on this biography and in asking, well, how does the imagination work? How does a genius, the imagination of a genius work? Now, Calder has always gave one explanation. He said he remembered in the fall of 1930 going to Mondrian's studio. And Mondrian's studio, this is Mondrian in his studio around that time in Paris. And on the right, you have a painting by Mondrian. Mondrian's studio was a mind-blowing place for many artists. And it wasn't just the paintings. It was the whole room. You came through a very dark corridor into a room with light streaming in from two sides. And there weren't actually that many paintings on display. But Mondrian had arranged on the walls of the studio, and you can see them here in this photograph, colored rectangles, so that the entire room became a kind of three-dimensional Mondrian painting. And Calder said, of seeing this room, of being there, he said, this was the thing that convinced me in my gut, in my heart, that I could be an abstract artist. And he went home and he began to paint abstractly. First paint abstractly. He did abstract paintings for a few months, and then he started to do abstract sculpture. Okay, so that's one element in Calder's shift from these wonderfully amusing, comic wire sculptures of acrobats, of dancers, of women who may or may not have been his lovers, we're not sure, of friends. The shift from that work to these very distilled abstractions, that was Calder's exploration. But one of the things I've really tried to emphasize in this biography is that the movements of a great imagination always have multiple, are the result of multiple forces. There are multiple forces at work. Now, what else happens between 1929 and 1931? Well, as I mentioned before, on the De Grasse, on the ship going back to New York, Calder, who's in his early 30s at the time, meets Louisa James. This is a wire portrait of her he does right around the time. Louisa James, who's a great niece of Henry James and William James, from a Boston Brahmin family, a kind of unconventional Boston Brahmin family. Her father got beat up protesting on behalf of Sacco and Vanzetti. Her father was a kind of eccentric leftist who unfortunately sort of turned into a rightist in the 1940s, but we won't talk about that today. But anyway, he meets Louisa James, and they have this wild romance that begins aboard ship. And many people have talked about the effect of this his love affair and his marriage on his work. People have pointed out that Louisa James had money, and when they got married, we think she was getting from her trust fund a check of maybe $200 a month, which in the 30s, in dollars, where they went back to France for the years, was not a bad amount of money. And people have said that, well, maybe this freed Calder in some way, and that if you assume he was doing the acrobats and the heads of his friends with the hope of making money, not that he sold many of them, maybe he felt free then to do exactly what he wanted to do, abstraction. So that's been another thought about the shift to abstraction. There's also something in their relationship that I think may come into play here. Before Calder married Louisa, a friend of his said to him, what does she do? And Calder said, she's a philosopher. And indeed, I found some of her books with her maiden name on them in the attic in the Calder house in Connecticut. And she had been reading Plato's The Socratic Dialogues a number of years before she met Calder. She was also reading Proust in the early 1920s when the volumes of his novel were coming out. So she was a kind of a pensive, thoughtful woman. And I think she was, in some sense, the philosopher of his life. Calder was this kind of ebullient, let's get on with it optimist. And his wife had more of a kind of contemplative and maybe sometimes a little bit melancholy side. And I think you could argue that the more philosophic turn of his work, the more contemplative nature of his work, might have had something to do with that. That when you look at a work like the work on the right called Musique de Varèse, these are kind of works for meditation or contemplation, and perhaps there was something about her that took him from the interest in athletes and acrobats to this more abstracted region. But there's something else. There's another thing that suddenly occurred to me as I was thinking about this shift from 1929 to 1931, from portraits of athletes, this is the shot putter, and acrobats and dancers, to these abstractions. What happens in the world between 1929 and 1931? The crash and the depression. And I began to think, and this is something nobody had ever talked about before. Calder's work of the 20s, when you think back to the Josephine Baker, throwing up her arms in her famous banana dance that thrilled Paris. Calder, the 20s, was, I think, one of the great poets, visual poets, of the champagne high of the roaring 20s. I mean, his early work is a product of the years of the Charleston peaks in 1926. And indeed, Calder and his wife loved to dance. They had dancing parties in Connecticut deep into the 1950s. Sometimes they would bring up jazz musicians from New York. And Calder's work of the 20s really reflects that kind of wild, crazy optimism of the 20s that is also reflected in Fitzgerald's novels. And an artist of Calder's profundity could not have gone on doing that kind of work in the wake of the crash and the depression. And so he turns toward this more inward, contemplative vision, which isn't the end of the story with Calder. There are moves back and forth in his work. One of the things I've loved about working with Calder is the richness of the achievement and the sense that he does something for a year or two and then he'll move in another direction. He'll do these very austere abstract works and then a year or two later he'll start bringing forms that suggest plants or animals into his work. At the very end of his life in the 1970s, he begins to actually make figures again that echo his work of the 1920s. So in some sense, this man who was fascinated by the circus is a kind of juggler of a variety of kinds of imagery. And he'll kind of be holding one kind of imagery aloft for a number of years, and then another kind of thing will come to the fore. But nothing in his repertory of images and ideas is ever gone forever. Things keep coming back in different ways, which makes him a wonderfully rich subject to spend as much time with as I have. Now, the last little kind of or big question I want to look at for a few minutes, and then I would invite you to ask questions. We can have a conversation. The third kind of creative question I want to ask about Calder is this turn toward the kinetic. Okay, this is the man, more than any other artist of the 20th century, who takes sculpture, which is the art of three dimensions, and moves it in to another dimension. Into what many people in his day talked about as the fourth dimension of time. There were a few artists who'd experimented with kinetic sculpture before Calder, in Germany, in Russia, but he is the man who embraced the idea of the kinetic, the idea of sculpture moving, and it's made it one of the central pursuits of his life, although not the only pursuit, because of course, even as he was doing mobiles, he was also making stabiles, these works which do not move. I mean, and then there's a whole genre of Calder work, which he thought of as the standing mobile, a mobile on a stable base. The mobiles don't only hang from the ceiling. There are even mobiles that kind of hang off the walls, or cantilevered off the wall, and then have mobile elements. So there are many different possibilities. But the idea of movement in sculpture, this was a tough idea to embrace, to even pursue in the 1930s. And part of its origin, I think, is in the Cirque Calder, this circus, which all of you know from the Whitney Museum, where it's now been on display for decades and decades. When Calder first arrived in Paris in 1926, he'd been painting in New York, doing paintings actually of the street life of New York, trying to capture the movement of people along the streets of the city. He comes to Paris. I don't think at that point he really wants to paint that much. I think he feels that he's moving in some other direction. He's not quite sure what it is. And he starts kind of fiddling around in the hotel room he's living in on the Rue Daguerre. He starts making these figures out of wire and wood and cloth and bits of stuffing. And he starts composing a circus with a few elements at first, and people start to come and see it. And the drama of the circus, it's really almost impossible to recapture the drama of the circus today. You can't catch it when you see it in a museum. And even the films of Calder performing the circus were done much later in the 1950s, when he already really did not perform it much. But for people who saw it in the 20s and 30s, you had this kind of tall, somewhat heavy, funny-looking, charming, delightful American guy in Paris crawling around with these foot-high figures and making them do things, making the lady jump onto the back of the horse, making the acrobats catch each other in the air. So he's already playing with the kinetic, though he does not as yet see it as a possibility for sculpture. Then, in the early first abstract sculptures, this is a work from around 1931, he started to make works that could be moved into different positions, so that this was kind of, in other words, this is on arranged so that you can kind of move this slightly one way or the other. He wasn't yet thinking of it actually as a sculpture that you watch as it moves, but he was thinking, well, maybe I should make something that can go this way or this way. And then in 1932, he has his first show of what he actually calls mobiles. He's given the idea for calling them mobiles by Marcel Duchamp, whom he's introduced to by Duchamp's partner, Mary Reynolds, one of the great figures in Bohemian Paris. And these are a couple of these, the early works, which were shown at the Galerie Vignon in 32. Some of the early works, many of the early works were motorized. There's a motor down here which makes this move. Some had were crank-driven. And this is the beginning of a revolution in sculpture. I mean, I think we've become so used to the idea of the mobile today that I think sometimes we forget how extraordinary this move into the fourth dimension of time was. So how did it happen? Well, I think the circus is a part of it. One of the ways to think about it is to think about Calder's sense of his own physicality. Calder was a guy who loved to move. You see him on the lower, this is in college at the Stevens Institute of Technology, this is Calder, he was on the lacrosse team. He was a terrible athlete. Everybody says so, he said so. But he loved to be out on the field even so. He loved moving, he loved running. He loved dancing. Here he is, this is his wife, Louisa, this is in the 30s. She liked playing the accordion, and this is Calder, you know, kicking up his heels with a friend at the house of another friend, the curator and collector James Thurl Sobey. As I said before, the Calders are remembered to this day. People my age who were kids in the 1950s remember being taken by their parents to parties at the Calders where the kids would go upstairs to go to sleep, and like a kid would wake up at 4 in the morning or 3 in the morning and come down, and the adults would be like throwing each other across the living room to these samba records that the Calders had picked up in Brazil. So Calder loved the kinetic. He loved to dance. So I think that's part of what brings him to the mobile. He also was an avid cyclist in his early years. This is a painting he did in New York before going to Paris of a 6-day bicycle race. And in his much later, in the 1960s, he did a performance, what he called a ballet with without dancers, in the Rome Opera House. And in one scene, he had cyclists in these brightly colored outfits doing figure eights around the stage, which I think was a recollection of his early days in Paris, where everybody who knew him then said he was always whizzing around on his bicycle. And if you think about a bicycle and a mobile, a man on a bicycle on this moving object, you can see that the mind would tend to think, well, if this bicycle moves, maybe sculpture can move. And there was a major fascination with the bicycle as taking you into movement among artists at this time. This is a painting by Boccioni from 1913, Dynamism of a Cyclist. On the right, you have Duchamp's first ready-made, which was a bicycle wheel, and Duchamp talked later about the pleasure of watching it move. So somehow cycling and the idea of the bicycle is connected with modernity and taking us from fixity into movement. I think that also plays into the coming of the mobile. And there's also this idea, which I've alluded to already, of dimensions beyond the third dimension, which was very, very popular in Paris in the Bohemian sculpture, Bohemian circles were called or moved at this time. And there's a Russian kind of crackpot mystic named Uspensky. Some of you may have heard of Uspensky, who wrote about not just the fourth dimension, but the fifth and the sixth and the seventh and the eighth and the ninth dimension. And if you read Uspensky, and then you look at a drawing like this by Calder from 1932, Uspensky talks about how the spiral or the helix takes you from one dimension into the other. And when you think about the importance of the spiral for Calder, I think this idea of breaking out of the three dimensions in which we live was very interesting to him, as it was to a very good friend of his, at the time, the musician Edgard, the composer Edgard Varèse, who also talked about trying to get this sense of fresh other alternate dimensions into sound. And Calder and Varèse talked a lot, and I think felt in these years that they were working in parallel. So I think what all of this suggests for me, and I try to suggest this in the biography, is that something like the thunderbolt, we might think of it as, of the discovery of the mobile. This is a gorgeous mobile called Vertical Foliage from 1941. Something like the thunderbolt of that discovery has these kind of multiple sources. It's not just his own passion for movement, whether on the athletic field or the dance floor or on a bicycle. It's not just the interest of other artists of the moment in the kinetic. It's not just mystical ideas about the fourth or fifth dimension, but somehow all of that together, and then with his own interest in his earlier paintings of the movement of people on the street, all this together somehow brings this artist to this revelation. Just as with the turn to abstraction, it's not just the visit to Mondrian's studio, it's not just his wife's money that frees him, it's not just his wife's contemplative spirit, it's not just the depression, it's again a multiplicity of things. And just as it's not his parents who simply by themselves made him who he was, I do think that when you look at Calder and who he is as a grown man, and many people commented on this, he was a man of almost preternatural confidence. He was never daunted by setbacks. When things didn't go his way, he just kind of had a glass of wine and forged ahead. He was fearless. And how does somebody become fearless? You know, it's nature, but it's also nurture. And when you look at this family he came from, this Philadelphia family, his parents, these two people who'd come together to devote themselves to the life of art, I think you begin to see how he was able to so totally embrace that life and embrace it with such extraordinary certainty. Thanks a lot. I mean, I'll be happy to entertain questions.
Thank you for a most fascinating talk. Could you tell us a little bit more about how you developed your interest in writing about Alexander Calder and how you won the access from the family to all of the works that you referred to?
I had always thought that if I would ever write a biography, I've never written a biography, I like writing different kinds of books, I always thought, well, the only person I could conceive of writing about was Alexander Calder for a number of reasons. I love the kind of transatlantic nature of the career. I mean, I'm fascinated both by the New York and Parisian art worlds. I'm also fascinated, and this is a sense more something I get into in volume two, the phenomenon of artist who is a vanguardist, who's an avant-garde figure, who becomes at the same time, without ever ceasing to be an avant-garde artist, becomes as immensely popular as Calder. So it's a very interesting kind of story of the mid-20th century. So I'd always thought all of this, and I'd always assumed, because I knew there was no biography, I'd assumed either somebody had been working on one for 30 years, which does sometimes happen, or else somebody was standing in the way. And about a decade ago, I crossed paths with Sandy Rower, the youngest of the four grandchildren who runs the absolutely extraordinary Calder Foundation. And we got to talking, and he had very much admired something I'd written a decade earlier, actually, when some of you may remember a big show at the National Gallery in Washington for the centennial, the 1998 centennial of Calder's birth. And I wrote a piece at that time for the New Republic. I used to, at the New Republic, enjoy combining different shows. And while the Calder show was in Washington, at the Museum of Modern Art, there were shows of the architect Alvar Aalto and the painter Fernand Léger. And I thought, oh, that seems like I could put those together. And then I started working on it. I realized they were very close friends. And I wrote a piece for the New Republic called Being Geniuses Together. And when I went to see Sandy Rower about some much smaller project a decade ago, he had this piece on his desk from a decade before. And he said, how did you do this? How did you know all this? I said, well, you know, I went to the library, whatever. So we ended up started talking, and he said, how did you know this without coming to talk to us? He basically said to me that they had been, that they for interesting reasons, I think they, and perhaps good reasons, they'd been hesitant about getting into a biography in the years right after Calder's death. I mean, it's in some ways it's been beneficial to wait a kind of long generation. Calder himself also had commissioned or encouraged a friend to write a biography in the 1950s, which he and his wife absolutely hated when they saw it, and it was never published. So there was sort of a tradition in the family of wariness about biography. And apparently the foundation turned down many biographers would come to them anyway, so we sort of circled around each other very suspiciously for a few months, and then we decided to take the plunge. And I was apprehensive initially because I'd never done a project where you're involved with a family and a foundation, but it has actually turned out to be an extraordinary experience. Calder's older daughter, Sandra Davidson, who's in her early 80s, is alive. But fortunately, Calder's younger daughter died a few years ago. I didn't get to know her that well, but Calder's older daughter, the grandchildren, everybody has been just extraordinarily supportive and really wanting to make a really serious, formidable, first-class book. And what ended up happening was that I'm really the first person who's been given unlimited access to the enormous archives of the Calder family. These people kept everything. There are prescriptions from pharmacies in the south of France in 1927 in the Calder archives. I mean, how these things were kept all this time. And Calder's going back and forth and back and forth from France to America. But so they have everything. The first years I was working on it, I mostly felt like I was just sort of dog paddling and drowning some of the time because there was so much. I don't know, after 3 or 4 years, I began to sort of feel my way. So it's been an incredible adventure, and it's not over yet.
So often when there are different generations and legacies of families who are artists or in the same field, there is a weightiness to it. And you don't mention him feeling like there was a weight on him to continue on with the Calder legacy. Do you feel that?
Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, both Calder's father and Calder himself, in some sense, avoided initially becoming sculptors. Calder's father, Sterling, whose father was Alexander Milton Calder, Sterling Calder writes in a memoir that he really wanted to be an actor or maybe even go to West Point. And then somehow the calling of art was overwhelming. Our Calder didn't know what he wanted to do when he was a teenager, and he and his sister were often driven crazy by their parents' kind of close alliance about art. And because Calder and his sister grew up in a family where they would sometimes be ignored because their parents were having some big discussion about whether line, Calder's father, sculptor, saying line is the most important thing. Calder's mother, the parents, saying no, it's color. So, you know, like, I don't know, dinner isn't on the table, and Calder's parents are, like, arguing about the value of line and color. So Calder he made all this stuff when he was a kid, but then he didn't know what he wanted to do, and he ended up going to college and studying engineering, after which for 4 years he kind of fell in and out of more than a dozen engineering jobs. Sometimes he was fired, sometimes he would leave. My feeling is by the time he got out of the Stevens Institute of Technology, which was a very good school, I think he knew that engineering was not really for him. And it was while living in the Pacific Northwest with his sister and her husband in 1923 that he kind of realized, well, I really do want to be an artist. So he resisted the pull. And his father, in fact, who extraordinarily recommended his son for a Guggenheim fellowship in the late 1920s, his father, in the recommendation for his son, says that, you know, he finally succumbed to the family profession. So there was resistance, and there, I would say between Calder and his father and his mother, there's an interesting push and pull. Calder and his father were very different personalities. His father was a kind of depressive figure, subject to doubt, melancholy. And Calder more took after his mother, who was a kind of let's get on with it type personality. And Calder would mock his father sometimes. He sometimes called him Sir Sterling because his father was a sort of dandyish person with, I guess, a kind of Anglophile taste. His father loved George Bernard Shaw's plays. So there was this kind of tension, and in the first years when Calder was just starting out as an artist, his father would sometimes blow his top and say, if only you had really gotten down to it with engineering, you wouldn't be like hanging around the house playing with the kittens, you know. So there was that. But the other side of it is this tremendous sense of family camaraderie. When Calder wanted to go to Paris at 26, his parents helped support him. And it gets bittersweet in the 40s because Calder's father's career, which is really doing monumental figure sculpture, goes into decline in the 30s. And by the time Calder dies in 1945, he is almost destitute. I mean, Sterling Calder, Calder's father, dies. And at that point, Calder, our Calder, the Mobile Calder, his career is really, really rising. Yet Calder's parents are incredibly enthusiastic about, like, his show at the Museum of Modern Art in 1943. So it's a very, I mean, I think like many family dynamics, it's a rich one and a complex one with, obviously, you know, people rub up against each other and there are rivalries and tensions between people. But I actually think the dominant note in this family was one of kind of delight in mutual interests and obsessions, really, I would say.
You mentioned cryptically at the end of, I think it was the answer to two questions before, that it's not over yet. And so my three-part question is, did you start out to write a multi-volume epic? And what will you cover in the next volume? And could you give us a little bit of an idea of where you stand on that in your progress?
I had originally actually been very determined that it was one volume because one of the things I don't like about the Calder story is generally told is there's this kind of avant-garde Calder of the 1930s, and then there's the boring Calder of the 1960s and 70s who makes that sculpture that's in front of the bank. You know what I mean? And I wanted, part of the point of this biography is to kind of link, show that they're one and the same person, really. Never boring. So I actually was hesitant about two volumes, but the story is just too big for one volume. Nobody could hold it. There is a draft of the entirety of volume two. I actually was getting to the end of the story by the time I realized it had to be two volumes. The story of volume two, which begins in 1940, is the story of an artist who begins to deal with a much wider public and a much wider world in some sense. it begins with the coming of the war, and that's a wonderful story because a lot of he and his wife's Bohemian friends from Europe end up in America, either permanently or for a number of years as exiles from Hitler's Europe. So kind of this whole world they had in Paris in a way arrives in America, and they become, the Calders, because they're bilingual, because they have this very cosmopolitan vision, they really become the go-to people for emigres, artistic, literary emigres. I mean, even people they didn't know in Europe, for instance, Saul Steinberg, the cartoonist, when he makes it from Italy finally to New York, he's hanging out with the Calders almost the minute he arrives. He didn't know them there, but they were easy in French as well as English, and they understood what it was like to live in different places, and they were very comfortable with that. So it begins with that. In 1943, as I mentioned before, Calder has this retrospective of the Museum of Modern Art, which is really, it's kind of a kingpin turning point where you go from this artist who's very admired among a small avant-garde world to an artist who's beginning to be recognized among an ever wider public. Although the real explosion in his reputation doesn't occur until after the war, in some sense until the 60s. But the second volume, which will be called The Conquest of Space, really one of the great stories there is about monumental abstract sculpture in public. Because, you know, today when you see a big abstract sculpture out somewhere, you think, oh yeah, a big abstract sculpture, no big deal. And we have really lost track of the fact that in the 1950s and 60s, and even into the 70s, there was a tremendous battle to get abstract sculpture, major abstract sculpture, into public places. In 1965, when some close friends of Calder collectors donated a large Calder Stabile to be outside at Lincoln Center in New York City, there was a monumental fight to be permitted for it to be there because the Parks Commissioner, who controlled the New York's Parks Commission, controls the exterior spaces at Lincoln Center. He said that there was no place for abstract sculpture outside in New York. This is in 1965, okay? So Calder, who had dreamed of doing big monumental things back in the 30s, this becomes one of one of the sort of central enterprises of his later years. And it's connected for him with ideas of kind of bringing to the public space, to the public sphere, all the ideas about the freedom of the imagination and the unfettered nature of the imagination that abstract art is about. And he had a close friend of his, critic and curator James Johnson Sweeney, wrote in the 50s, he said, you know, we don't any longer want to have sculptures, whether they're of Stalin or Hitler or of Abraham Lincoln, that force you to focus on like the single person. What we want in public are sculptures that allow the citizen of a democratic society to roam freely and think freely. And that's really the enterprise in which Calder was engaged, and he's never been given credit for it. So that's just a taste of volume two.
So I know that a number of years ago, there was a planned Calder Museum in Philadelphia, and there was a sculpture garden up on the other side of the parkway for a little while. Do you know anything about the story of why that idea fell apart?
I probably know much more than I should say. I would just say that my understanding of it at this point, is that I think political greed in Pennsylvania and Philadelphia nixed it, would be my sense, and I will say no more. The Calder family and foundation were going to be deeply involved in that, and they are. Partly because Calder sold almost nothing in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. The Calder family and foundation are the possessors of the most extraordinary collection of major Calder works because nobody bought anything. And they are, of course, extraordinarily generous with them. I know those of you who have recently been to the National Gallery in Washington, Tower 2 is now a Calder gallery, and much of the work there comes from the Calder Foundation. I mean, the works of the Calder Foundation are constantly out and about in the world. But I think it was the complexities of state and local politics. This is my sense of it now that kind of nixed it. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.